Hello, with me today is Tom Slater, co-manager of Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, which has just published a strong set of annual results showing a growth in the portfolio of over 13% to the end of March. But what's been really striking has been the strength of the performance in the shares since then, up 23% or thereabouts, and giving the Scottish Mortgage its first time valuation of £10 billion. So Tom, a lot of people have been surprised by the strength of Scottish Mortgage's performance during the coronavirus crash, and particularly maybe thinking of the performance of the trust in the last financial crisis, when you know the long-term performance is good, but there was a steep fall back then. That hasn't happened to such an extent this time. Were you surprised by the resilience of the portfolio?
I think you have to look at the nature of the crisis and. What we've seen is that some of these transformations that have been playing out over past years and decades have been compressed into a much shorter time horizon. People have been increasingly socializing using online tools. When you're trapped at home, you obviously significantly increase your usage. We've seen the transformation of the enterprise and people moving away from paper-based processes to digital processes. If you can only work from home, then you really have little choice but to embrace these digital tools. I think you've just seen this sort of this marked acceleration in the take-up of these services. I guess the core of what we do at Scottish Mortgage is try to identify the big drivers of change, the big opportunities that are, and back them over very long periods of time. If you can identify robust companies, which are strong financially, which have visionary leadership, then you can't ever predict what's going to happen in the short run, but you can aspire to have a portfolio of companies that are going to handle whatever is thrown at them. And I think that's what we've lived through in the recent weeks.
And is there a certain amount of vindication that you and James Anderson feel? Because you've both been predicting for the past few years that there were great swathes of the FTSE 100. There's some big stocks there looked very vulnerable. Has the coronavirus, accelerated? We've seen the oil price collapse. We've seen Shell cut its dividend. There's some of these big bastions of the FTSE 100 having a very difficult time. You've avoided these areas. You're investing in companies that are benefiting from the change away from that, the new world. So, people did associate you with kind of like technology-backed investments, which would be more volatile, more high growth, more volatile. There's been volatility there, but it's been to a less extent than other stock market funds.
We only own shares in businesses. We're not short sellers. We don't ever bet against companies. We take no pleasure in companies struggling. There's clearly a lot of hardship out there, and there's a lot of difficult times for people. But I think what's really important is for active managers who charge active management fees, not simply to invest broadly across the market to give people an exposure to a broad swathe of what's going on today. Instead, if you're going to charge active management fees, you want managers who are going to take a view on what's changing in the future, where the opportunities are going to be over the next 5 or 10 years, and offer an exposure which is very different from the one you get just by investing broadly across the market. And I think the new opportunities come from areas where the traditional ways of doing things are starting to encounter significant challenges. Where if something's always been done in a particular way, but the costs of doing that increase, or if you take the example of energy generation, the traditional carbon intensive way of doing things has driven huge economic progress across the past 100 years. But you're now at a point where you can see that the costs of continuing to drive growth through that model are starting to outweigh the benefits. Right? If that's the circumstances, well, who are the, you know, there are going to be people, there are going to be companies that are going to exploit that opportunity and create huge value for shareholders. So our job is to find those individuals, find those companies, and then back them for the long term.
Yeah, it was striking reading the results today. I mean, myself and most other people are, you know, were stuck within this COVID-19 pandemic. It's very hard to see, you know, what's going on, where we're going. And you and James are saying, saying renewable energy, the move to the rise of renewable energy and the electrification of transport, you know, that's more significant than the pandemic. Can you say a bit more about why that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're living through is a predictable shock to the global economy. You know, if you look at what scientists have been saying in the areas of epidemiology and virology, you know, this isn't an event that is, you know, in Taleb's terms, a black swan. This is entirely predictable by science. And it's had devastating economic consequences. Well, it doesn't take a genius to join the dots to that and what we see in climate change. You know, the scientists have been increasingly strident about the challenges we face. You know, we've had an extreme example of the impact that can have on the economy. And then at the same time, you've even before the lockdown and the crisis hit, You've seen a massive decline in oil prices, in the share prices of the major oil producers. You know, I think there's some valuable information in what the market has been telling us, even in the pre-COVID times. And I think it is in part just a consequence of this long-term decline in the cost of energy generation from renewable sources, this long-run decline in the cost of energy storage and batteries. I think predicting the macroeconomic variables is almost impossible. But actually, you've had some really predictable trends that have been driving this change. You know, cost of generating electricity from solar minus 20% a year, something of that order. Cost of energy storage, but about double-digit declines. Yeah. And those things don't play out in one spectacular moment in one particular year, but the cumulative impact of those changes eventually becomes, you know, very challenging to the status quo.
Yeah. Now, two of the biggest holdings, Tesla is now, was briefly the biggest holding in the company, but now Amazon is back to its previous position. But those are also big, significant US companies doing exactly what you're talking about. It's been a quiet year, relatively quiet year in terms of portfolio changes. So Amazon's back at number one, over 9% of assets. Can you remind us about why do you still retain so much conviction in that company?
Yeah, well, if you take Amazon and look at what's been happening recently, they have been faced with a situation where they are not demand constrained. You know, as we've been unable to go out and shop, you know, people have relied more and more heavily on this company. It is in the infrastructure of our commercial economy, and we've been really encouraged by how they've responded to that challenge. We're not trying to this is not an opportunity to make lots of money in the short run. Instead, we've just seen the typical Amazon playbook, which is, first of all, you know, we need to do our role as a good corporate citizen and really help to be part of the solution to the massive problems that people are facing. But at the same time, you know, we're having all of these customers who are looking at, you know, are depending on us for a much broader range of products than they have historically. You know, that potentially is a behavior change which could drive demand for the next decade. Similarly, there's lots of people that haven't used the service that are now trying it out. So what do you do under that circumstances where you sort of sit back and say, wow, this is fantastic. Look at all this extra money we're making. Instead, their response is, right, we're going to go out and we're going to invest 4 billion dollars in response to what's happening in our business at the moment. You know, we're going to be leaders from this perspective of safety of employees, and we're going to drive wages for our employees through this period. You were going to take on a huge number of new employees. I think 175,000 new employees they took on in the previous quarter. And that's at a time when everybody else is retrenching. You know, show me a physical retailer which won't be running its business for cash over the next 6 months. How do we get our balance sheet back in shape? How do we get rid of stock? How do we cut our costs accordingly? Can we renegotiate on our rents? And you know, while everybody else is retrenching, they've put their foot on the accelerator, $4 billion. You know, what happens to the relative competitive position over the next decade is, you know, to me, it's abundantly clear. And I think you see that more broadly across the portfolio. In times of stress, the leading companies aren't focused on shoring up their financial position. Instead, they can get on and invest and grasp the new opportunities, whilst everybody else is focused on other issues.
So your faith in Amazon and in Tesla and coming out of this crisis stronger than they went into it is obviously intact. But generally, you seem to be critical or sceptical of US leadership, both politically and in business. And you see the sort of influence of the world moving towards Asia and China. Is that are you investing more in the Chinese internet companies and the new generation of companies that are coming behind them?
I think there are lots of issues tied up in that question. I think the first one is that there is simply a matter of arithmetic that the Western economies will likely shrink this year. Asian economies will likely grow this year. So without any kind of political viewpoint, you just see an acceleration in the relative economic importance of Asia and in particular China. I think at another level, we've continued to see an incredibly rapid pace of innovation in the Chinese consumer sector. And that you see that partly in the development of some of our existing holdings, companies like Alibaba, companies like Tencent, which are the commercial infrastructure of China, but also in the emergence of new big companies coming out of that online ecosystem. So, you know, to make some of that a bit more specific, you know, a company like Facebook is one of the dominant online networks in the Western world. You know, from a product perspective, they've been playing defense for really quite a period of time now, addressing data security, privacy issues. If you look at the big innovations to come out of that company from a product perspective in the past couple of years, it's quite hard to point to something. But the pace of change at companies like Alibaba and Tencent has been really quite ferocious, and if anything, has accelerated through this period. But likewise, if you look at the new companies coming through, we own Meituan Dianping, a local services company in China. You know, they do meal delivery. Now compare the performance of that company to someone like Grubhub in the US. Grubhub has faced serious growth challenges. Meituan, on the other hand, has come through a period of vicious competition, has emerged one of the victors, and actually that dominance now continues to grow. Grubhub delivers about 500,000 meals a day in the US. Meituan delivers 20 million meals a day. It has economies of scale which are of a different order of magnitude to the ones from which Grubhub benefits. And so I think those are some of the trends that we're talking about that are driving some of that Chinese progress.
Okay. Can we move on to healthcare? Because investors in healthcare and the public are very aware there's a huge amount of research going on to finding a cure, an antidote to COVID-19, obviously. But and healthcare is an increasingly important area in the portfolio. But you were commenting that there actually didn't seem to be that many developments going on as far as you were concerned. Which did surprise me, given the focus on research around the pandemic. What areas are you interested in?
I think healthcare, and I've put education, a lump of education in with healthcare at this point. You know, these have been industries which have been very resistant to technology-led change. And I think what's interesting about the current moment is that actually you're seeing change forced upon them. You're seeing schools trying to adapt to embrace digital tools to deliver education virtually in a way that would have taken decades in other circumstances. Similarly, healthcare, we've waiting for a while to see the rise of telemedicine and people stopping visiting primary care physicians in quite the numbers that they have. But it's taken a shot like this to really drive adoption of some of those tools. And so it'll be really interesting to see which of those changes stick over the coming months and years and which are just reflect a temporary change in behavior because of the restrictions. But it's all tied into this broader thing of seeing years of progress condensed into weeks. That, as you alluded to, has been an important driver of what's happened in the portfolio. I think more broadly in healthcare, I was just going to touch on, it takes some a company like Illumina that make genomic testing machines. It has been really quite a quiet year for Illumina. The pace of growth and the uptake of this technology has been behind what we might have been expecting at this point. But the other side of it, and you alluded to this in your question, the whole response to COVID-19 is predicated around sequencing. We've got to sequence the genome of the virus. That's the pace of doing that is just so much faster than it has been in response to past pandemics. The fact that you had companies with vaccine candidates in the clinic in such a short period of time is completely a function of sequencing. The tests that we're doing for COVID-19 also rely on the prevalence of cheap sequencing. So I don't think anything that's happening affects our belief that sequencing is a really important technology for the future. But equally, we also have to face the reality that in the delivered results of Illumina, it's probably not at this point growing as fast as we would have hoped.
Okay, thank you. Now, as the investment trust continues to evolve, one of the areas that you want to do even more in is private equity, investing in unquoted companies before they reach the stock market. This has been an area in which you and James have been pretty focused on in recent years, and about 20% of the assets are invested in, is it about 40 companies, private companies? But you've got an existing limit of 25%, but you want to raise that to 30%. Why?
Well, our aim is to invest in the best large growth companies in the world that we think have the best prospects over the next 5 or 10 years. And it's really going back probably eight years when we made the first one, sizable one of these investments. Based on the observation that more and more of these companies were staying in private markets for longer, and that if we want to maintain our opportunity set, then we have to go looking at private companies. These are not startups; they're not small companies. Some of these private companies would be the largest listed company in the UK if they were in the UK stock market. That example being Ant Financial, the Chinese finance company. But the advantage of the investment trust structure is that we can own these businesses regardless of whether they're public or private. In fact, it makes very little difference to us. We're after the long run value creation. So if the most exciting, promising companies are private, we should own them and not worry too much about that structure point.
It's a great argument, but I just wonder, private holdings have been steadily increasing, and it plays well with the investment trust structure. You're not ever going to be forced sellers because of that closed-end structure. But there is a sort of creeping sense that private equity is becoming bigger and bigger. How far are you going to go? 50% more?
I think what we're absolutely trying to avoid is a sort of creeping against people's expectations. So, if you go back a few years, we had no constraints on the amount that we could invest in private companies. And then through a vote at the annual general meeting, we added this limit of 25%, so that our shareholders had the opportunity to express their opinion on whether we should be doing this, and it gave them a clear marker as to what our expectations were. As we have done more and more of it, had more experience, seen some of the returns, we've come to the view that that we need a bit more capacity to do it. The manager's going to start to become constrained with the current limit. But because of the structure we've put in place, we're going back and asking shareholders to raise that limit. So it's not a steady creep. It's very explicitly going to shareholders saying, we think this is adding value to you. We think this is really important. We would like your permission to increase this limit. So there's no creeping. It's a very clear dialogue with the investors in the trust.
But there was a recently, this part of the portfolio was written down in value after the substantial stock market declines in March. The board of trust wrote down the value of these unquoted holdings. It didn't say by how much, but I think analysts reckon it's around 6%, which was in line with the stock market movements. Is that a fair comment?
Well, the critical point here is that we keep these investments on the books at what we think their current market value is. So we don't just hark back to the historic price that we paid. Instead, the accounting treatment is our best estimate would be of what the transaction price would be today. So if you see very steep declines in the value of listed assets, then I think there's a reasonable read through that these private assets, which are valued relative to their public peers, ought to see their value written down as well. We have to handle that very thoughtfully. We think one of the challenges for public companies is they're operating in this environment of huge volatility in their stock prices, and it potentially impacts their own investment decisions. So we don't want to be the mechanism of passing that volatility through to our underlying private companies. But we make sure that we have the asset values that we publish, the underlying asset backing to our shares is as current a best estimate as possible of what the value of those companies is.
But can I just clarify, was this a sort of generic write down reflecting the market crash, or were there company specific issues as well?
So we revalue on a rolling basis these assets every 3 months. And if there is some trigger in between that 3 month cycle, then we will act upon that at that time as well. And so, what you're talking about here is that the dramatic declines in the value of listed assets was seen as a trigger over and above this ongoing cycle of revaluing these investments. What's going on elsewhere is sufficiently material to trigger an appraisal of these assets. We don't do it on a blanket basis. You look at the listed peers of the individual companies. For certain companies, it may be that these aren't specific examples or even specific ones to the trust, but with what was going on in the market, you saw video conferencing companies like Zoom, their shares were doing very well, or biotechnology companies that were addressing infectious disease did very well when everything else was declining. So if you held those type of assets, you wouldn't necessarily write them down just on the back of a market decline. So it's being thoughtful about what the company actually does when the last valuation points were as well. Okay. And that's all done in conjunction with external valuation companies. It has nothing to do with the fund managers. It's done by a valuation committee that is distinct from the fund managers, And then you have the additional oversight of the independent board of directors of the trust.
Okay. And are you pleased with the fact that you do have a very, you know, there's 40 or so stocks in that private portfolio, and you're saying more and more with each report a bit about how they're performing, and there's quite a range in performance. So advertising agency, you and Mr. Jones, has been growing at an annualized rate of 26%, I read, since you invested in it in 2015. But there are other investments like Intarsia Therapeutics, that's down, that seems to have halved. But was that your approach, that you would get some winners and you're going to have some losers as well, and you didn't want to have be too exposed to any one individual company?
Yeah, I think, you know, we come back to what's the aim of this. It's to own the best growth companies that we think have the biggest opportunities in the world. And, you know, we're taking calculated risk in doing that. You know, that not all of these companies are going to be successful at embracing that opportunity. Otherwise, this would just be easy. But the crucial thing is that the returns that accrue to the companies that are successful will far outweigh the losses in the ones that ultimately don't manage to capitalize on that opportunity. And that's true in public markets, and it's also true in private companies. So, you know, we absolutely go into these ones not expecting that all of them will make money. And indeed, some we will lose money, some we'll lose all our money. But the returns that you get from the successful investments will more than pay for that. And so, yes, you have examples like you and Mr. Jones. This is an advertising agency business. The founder, the former CEO of the listed agency Havas, spotted this opportunity in helping enterprises move their advertising campaigns and marketing campaigns onto the digital era to harness the tools of online commerce. And has assembled this and astutely navigated this rapidly changing environment for advertisers. And that's something that the corporate world has really embraced. And so, you know, there are examples like that, or Ginkgo Bioworks in the field of synthetic biology. And there are companies like Intarsia that you mentioned that have, you know, they have faced issues as they've tried to address the opportunities they were presented with, and that's inevitable, and we should just be upfront about that.
When those companies do have problems, I mean, if they end up, you know, doing very badly, do you just write them off completely? I mean, can you exit a private equity holding that goes wrong, or do you just have to hold it to the bitter end? I mean, I think that's why people, if they, you know, they've seen generally, the overall performance has been good, but if they have any questions around this, is that, you know, it is an inherently illiquid strategy.
So I think the first of all, you the challenge would be to say, well, what are you comparing it with? You know, if you own a listed company where things go wrong, do you think the fact it's listed will allow you to get out before all that value has been destroyed? You know, it's very likely that the vast majority of the wealth destruction will happen long before you have the opportunity to sell the shares. So really, you're talking about what happens to the residual. And the first thing to remember is, you know, in terms of the structure of returns, that really matters very little. You know, a company that's gone down a lot, the residual is likely to be a very small proportion of the portfolio. Whereas if you've had one of these things that's been successful and has doubled or tripled or more, then it's become a much larger part of the portfolio. So it's actually what happens to the winners that influences the end result much more than, you know, what's happened to the assets that are in companies that have experienced problems. But then I guess the subsequent point is absolutely correct. It's much, much harder, if not impossible, to get out of some of these positions, particularly when the underlying business is performing badly. So, you know, we just start on with that premise. The good thing about investing in private markets is there are often a lot more protections for shareholders than there are simply from holding ordinary shares that are listed on stock markets. Yeah, you know, you may sit further up the capital structure so that you as an owner, you will be paid out before other investors in those vehicles. and it may be that there are additional protections that protect you, you know, if, even if the value simply declines. Now, that's not why we invest in these companies. You know, as I say, our focus is on, you know, the potential upside, not protecting the downside. But nevertheless, the broad trend is you have a lot more protection than you would in a listed company.
Okay, well, thanks very much for talking about that part of the portfolio. Looking, just getting towards the end of my questions here, but looking more broadly at the portfolio, the chair of the trust remarked today that you've made no specific changes in the portfolio in response to COVID-19. But can you tell us a bit more how you've been, you know, stress testing? We've heard from Baillie Gifford elsewhere earlier this year that you know, fund managers have been kicking the tires on their investments, make sure that they, you know, the balance sheets are strong and everything. You've been doing similar work, have you?
Yes. Yeah, so the, you know, if you look at the collection of companies that we own, they have a starting point of a very strong financial position. You know, the aggregate balance sheet of the portfolio is strongly net cash. Whereas if you look at the market as a whole, there's a significant net debt position, but nevertheless, when you sort of think about capitalizing on these long run opportunities, you know, the first thing you have to do is to survive. So you know, there is of course this discipline of making sure that not just on average, but specifically each of the companies that you own, you know, has that ability to endure what are likely to be difficult conditions. And then in terms of incremental capital deployment, can you find opportunities to help companies to get on the front foot and exploit the opportunities that are put in front of them? So, you know, if you look at say, something like Tesla, you know, we Baillie Gifford were, you know, supported their capital raising in the earlier months of this year, which puts them in a really strong balance sheet position to push on and develop new products and compete for new customers in this electric vehicle market. And what you're seeing elsewhere is retrenchment, cutting of investment plans, concern about balance sheets. You know, I think their relative position to the traditional automakers just gets stronger and stronger through this type of environment.
Okay, Tom, it sounds like that you're very much trying not to get too gloomy about the world. Lots of people are very scared by recent events. Is that right? You're seeing the positives out there through the gloom.
I think that we have to be very careful about making pronouncements about what's going to happen in a hugely uncertain environment, and we remain absolutely in the teeth of this crisis at this point. But it's there's a real danger of extrapolating from the immediate situation that we find ourselves in. You know, yes, it's scary. Yes, there are bad things happening. But that doesn't mean that this situation is going to persist forever either. We're programmed to extrapolate from what we can see around us in the immediate term. But it's extremely hard when you're inside the bubble of this to see beyond it. But actually, a very small amount of a company's value lies in what happens over the next 3 months or the next 6 months. You know, the value of that company is the present value of the cash flows from the company into eternity. Yes, there's going to be stress and strains on the economy in the coming months and maybe even years. But actually, for the companies that are adaptable, that have financial flexibility, that are able to address what their clients and their customers need, in this changing environment, the opportunities remain plentiful. It ties back into some of your opening comments about why has the trust continued to perform strongly through this current environment. It's because it's invested in the companies that are able to help their clients and their customers through what we're going through and then into the recovery phase.
Well, Tom, thanks very much for helping me look beyond the bubble of COVID, and very interesting to talk to you. So thanks for making the time.